Tom Hoos from Earlton, New York, and I'm listening to WGXC Acra, New York.
WGXE welcomes audio responses and feedback from listeners. Anyone can call and leave a message and we'll play it on the air. Call area code 518-622-2598 and leave up to a 3-minute message for airplay. That number again is 518-622-2598. WGXC underwriting is provided in part by WS Carpentry and Services LLC, offering carpentry, renovations, interior and exterior painting, as well as refinishing. Information at wscarpentryandservices.com or area code 518-755-5152.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of the Curtin family of Tivoli, New York. WGXC supporters care deeply about creative community radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Friday, May 23rd. Local early morning temperatures range from 40 degrees in Tannersville to 44 in Kinderhook. Regional average soil temperature is 54 degrees. Pollen levels today will be low. And that's because it's going to be another rainy day, especially this afternoon. We get a high of 55 at 5 p.m. Overnight, it will still be wet as temperatures fall to 46 degrees. Saturday, rain might happen for some, but it does start to clear out. We get a high of 60 happening at 4 p.m. Overnight, we'll be dry with a low of 45. Sunday, we get a high of 65 at 4 p.m. and perhaps a few passing raindrops in the afternoon. Monday, same deal. Chance for some afternoon rain and a high of 70. Sunset today will be at 8:01 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 5:24 a.m. Looking way up, we see X-class flare chances are at 5%. Plasma winds will be average at 476 kilometers per second with a thin density of 2 protons per cubic centimeter. Radio propagation conditions are currently being impacted above 18 megahertz with an S1 level noise floor. There are no chances of aurora this evening. The current sunspot number is 99. And this has been The Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
The Public News Service Friday afternoon update. I'm Mike Clifford. Harvard University opening a new front in its legal battle against the Trump administration, filing suit in federal court Friday in response to the government's move to revoke the school's ability to enroll international students. That from CNN. They report the complaint by the nation's oldest and wealthiest institution of higher education argues the decision Thursday to drop the school from the Department of Homeland Security's Student and Exchange Visitor Program violates the law. Quoting from the complaint, it is the latest act by the government in clear retaliation for Harvard exercising its First Amendment rights to reject the government's demands to control Harvard's governance, curriculum, and the ideology of its faculty and students. Meantime, it will take both collective change and individual action to make headway against climate change. That's according to a new report from the World Resources Institute.
Around a third of global greenhouse gas emissions come from food, largely driven by the production of red meat. Ornelas says shifting diets away from meat and dairy may not solve the climate crisis alone, but eating less meat can be one empowering individual choice made stronger in large numbers.
Our food choices are powerful in how what we say about ourselves. They're powerful in terms about what we say about the society in which we want to live in.
United Nations research also suggests people eat less beef and shift to more plant-forward diets. Nadia Romlagan reporting.
This story with original reporting by Jessica Scott Reed for Sentient. And May is National Foster Care Month, and in Kentucky, advocacy groups across the political spectrum say the state hasn't done enough to keep kids out of foster care, including addressing the high number of parents who are incarcerated. Sarah Durand with KY Free says the consequences of going through childhood without a parent are lifelong.
If we can keep keep families together by getting families the help that they need, we know that that increases the likelihood of children being successful.
A report from the conservative free market group Kentucky Forum for Rights, Economics and Education, or KY Free, finds the state would save $74 million in direct incarceration costs and $740 million annually through indirect socioeconomic costs if parents had alternatives to doing prison time. And professional motorsport drivers often start competing behind the wheel at a young age. We get more in this Mirror Indy Free Press Indiana Public News Service collaboration.
Many are introduced to the sport as youngsters through soapbox derby car contests. Indianapolis is home to the Wilbur Shaw Memorial Soapbox Derby Hill on Indianapolis's west side. Parent Melanie Weaver says a Facebook post caught her son's attention, and he asked if he could try it out.
The first time our son went down the hill, he just absolutely loved it. It's speed and fun.
The first soapbox derby car contest was held in 1934 in Ohio. I'm Terry D. reporting.
This is Public News Service. A section of legislation in the North Carolina General Assembly would provide legal immunity for pesticide companies.
The provision is part of the North Carolina Farm Act of 2025. Section 19 limits legal liability for harms from pesticides because of U.S. Environmental Protection Agency labeling on the potential dangers of the chemicals. But Kendall Wimberly with Toxic Free North Carolina says the section tips the scales toward industry in the courts.
This bill would shield all pesticide manufacturers from legal responsibility. It would rig the system against farmers, workers, and families who suffer from exposure to toxic chemicals while rewarding corporate misconduct.
The company Bayer, which owns Roundup and is behind the campaign for legal immunity, has paid millions in settlements over harm from the pesticide. Wimberly says the provision sets a dangerous precedent not just for pesticide, but for any polluting industry seeking immunity in North Carolina. I'm Eric Tegedoff reporting.
And as students graduate across Tennessee, a new report shows many adults still hope to earn a college degree, but high cost and limited access often stand in the way.
About 4 in 10 adults in Tennessee have at least a 2-year associate's degree. Research by Gallup and Lumina Foundation focuses on nearly 14,000 U.S. adults aged 18 to 59 who don't have a degree. Some are in college now, but others are not, and many express a willingness to try again. Lumina Foundation's Courtney Brown says while belief in higher education is strong, most people don't think getting a degree is within their reach.
They have a belief in the value of higher education. Yet, only 30% of Americans believe that they have access to quality, affordable education beyond high school.
Brown points out nearly 1 in 3 students now enrolled in college have considered stopping out for mental health reasons. For Public News Service, I'm Danielle Smith.
Finally, tax revenue from marijuana sales in Montana will now support a wider variety of conservation projects.
The new law will put about $12 million of annual tax revenue into a new Habitat Legacy account. 3/4 of the money is earmarked for state projects like conservation easements, water storage, and wildlife management areas. The remaining funds will support wildlife habitat. Democratic Representative Becky Edwards of Bozeman says the law cements conservation as a beneficiary of marijuana sales.
It's not going to be up for negotiation every legislative session. It provides certainty that those dollars will be there for state park creation, trails, wildlife habitat, all the things that are so important to us as Montanans.
Montana conservation groups are also celebrating a win on the national stage. Many were concerned that public land sales in Nevada and Utah would be authorized in the Republican budget reconciliation bill, but those were removed through amendments announced Wednesday. I'm Kathleen Shannon.
This is Mike Clifford for Public News Service, member and listener supported. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Welcome. You're listening to the afternoon show on WGXC Acra 90.7 FM radio for open ears. And I'm your host, Simone Stevens, and I'm here with Sean Allison. He's a writer, producer, performer of his acclaimed one-man show, If It Bleeds, It Leads. Hi, Sean.
Hey, Simone. How you doing? Thanks a lot for having me. It's really great to be here. This is going to be fun.
I'm so excited you're here. For those who don't know, we're in the Catskill studio, so we're just right on the street. We're looking out at the rainy day and, you know, the Friday night traffic going by, right? We're across from Magpie Bookshop. It's a pretty idyllic
It is
little
the
setup.
Quintessential American small town scene outside the window right now. It's really nice.
It's dreamy. It's dreamy.
Yeah.
So how long have you lived up here?
I started working in Hudson in October of 2007, and I moved up here in 2015. Okay. I ended up buying a house in 2017.
So you were convinced pretty quick. You were like, okay, a couple years in, I'm ready, I'm buying a house.
Well, I got kind of an opportunity. I think I actually bought the last affordable house in Hudson. I really think that that's true because I was looking and I could not have afforded any other one.
Past 2017.
Yeah. No, even at that time, there was one house in the town that I could have afforded. And I ended up getting it. And actually, you know, it was cheaper by like a couple hundred bucks than my rent. But I did really like, I had a great spot on North 5th Street that I lived. And I really liked it, and I was more than ready to leave the city. Mm-hmm. So, and I already had a long time before that anyway. I was living in Cold Spring and Newburgh mm-hmm. before that, and a lot of other places.
So you were slowly making your way upstate.
Well,
north.
I would have
going north.
I would have left in 2007 or so. I would have left New York City permanently, but I had a girlfriend at the time, and she was a Pilates teacher in the city, so we split the difference and moved.
She had a good following, solid following in the
I think
the
she
city.
Was reluctant to move up to such a rural spot, whereas I was like with a 125-pound ridgeback ready to come up here.
It really is such an interesting, I mean, my last partner too, I think you come to a crossroads sometimes when your partner is like, you're either a rural person or you're not. Like, you can either imagine that life or you can't. It's like nails on a chalkboard.
Yeah, to me, I think my best days and nights in the city are behind me.
Yeah.
And
so what do those involve, pray tell?
Oh, my. Well, for some of that, you'd have to come see my show, but we could talk about that, too. You know, I mean, my history with New York City is long because I was born in Chicago, but we spent time in L.A. and San Francisco. And then when I was six, my mother put the house on the market and told my dad he needed to find a new job someplace else because she was moving.
Wow.
And so he got a job in D.C., but we only stayed there for 8 months, and then we ended up in New York. So by the time I was 7 years old, I'd lived in like three or four states. And I forget the number, but it's like going to like four different or five different schools or something like that.
Oh, wow.
So my history, and we moved to we lived in a hotel on 53rd and 6th for the first summer that we were in the city because our moving van got robbed in Newark, New Jersey.
Oh, no.
No, it was great. I mean,
oh,
it was
you're
great.
Like, are
I mean,
you
I
kidding?
I was 7 years old. That part of it didn't matter to me. I loved being in
you're
the
like,
city.
You're like, loss of stuff? Who cares?
That wasn't my stuff. You know, I mean, I could see the problems it was causing, but I mean, my brother and I just skateboarded in Central Park every day and did whatever we wanted. So it wasn't that bad. I liked it. And that's how New York City started for me. I remember very clearly the first time driving into New York City, and that's how I learned how to spell restaurant off the awning there, and
wow.
Asking my mom what's a Big Apple and stuff like that.
Do you ever have to remind yourself, even though that's when you first learned how to spell restaurant, I feel like it's something I need to keep relearning. For some reason, that word just trips me out. I'm like, is it the A or the U or the U or the A?
I know. There are a lot. It does do that. Yeah, and the way I always solve that, I do have that very same thing. And the way that I solve that problem is I say to myself, restaurant.
See, I'm learning. That is a tip because it still comes up for me. It still comes up for me.
It doesn't solve the problem. It just gets you past it in
right,
the moment.
Right,
right. You know? But sometimes it's good enough.
But you had a magical entrance into New York City. Is that fair to say?
Kind of, yeah. I've always had a very good relationship with New York City, and it has always been a place that offered a lot to me. Like, I went to boarding school for high school, and then in 10th grade, I had the opportunity to spend 11th grade in Barcelona, Spain, which I got to do. But my mom was like, the tuition was the same, whether I was at this boarding school or in Spain.
Mm-hmm.
But my mom said that I had to come up with all the spending money. We're talking about 10 months in Europe worth of spending money at 16 years old. So once I got in, I had to solve that problem, which luckily New York City offered me the perfect solution because I spent the summer dressing up like King Kong at the Empire State Building.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
And you know what? It turned out, now this is in 1988, and I was 16 years old.
Was this officially your first job?
No. My first job that I ever really had, I used to caddy when I was like 11 or 12.
That's swanky.
Well, there was a country club in the town where I grew up, and it was like adults. It was like dudes who caddied, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I was too young to carry bags. Like, I couldn't. They were too big. So
yeah.
I would just carry putters. And it was like, they called it forecatting. I'd move the carts around and stuff, and I'd get $6 a putter plus tips. I'd do two loops a day, and I'd end up with like 50 or 60 bucks. It was pretty good.
Hey.
Yeah, it was a good racket. No,
yeah.
It was a lot of money. You know, I had cash in my pocket, which is more than I could say for myself right now sometimes.
The caddy days, sweet caddy days.
No, and then I got a job in a restaurant. That was like a real job for adults. I was like bussing tables till 2 in the morning. And they used to sell me beers after work, but that's probably a whole
my
like 15.
Gosh. Oh, yeah. New York City.
No, that was in Pelham in Westchester.
Oh, okay.
That restaurant's still there.
Yeah.
Yeah, but then I got the Empire State Building job, and that job, it turned out, was Broadway Costumed Performers Union gig. So in 1988, I made $17 an hour.
Wow.
Yeah.
At 16 years old?
Yeah. Yeah, it was crazy. I would get these like $1,200 paychecks.
So you were able to save for the 10 months abroad.
Oh, yeah.
Abroad.
And more.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
I would like cash the paychecks, literally have like $1,200 in cash in my backpack and ride my skateboard down to Bleecker Street and like buy t-shirts at Bleecker Bob's, you know, getting ready for Spain. So I would have cool rock and roll t-shirts when I got there.
Expendable income.
It was great. And you know, the best part, another kind of example of this is that I was the tallest King Kong that they'd had, because I was already like over 6 feet by the time I was 16 or something. And so I spent a whole day getting fitted for this King Kong costume at a puppeteer shop on Union Square, this woman who was like a professional puppet maker or something. And so I
Union,
had
also she was probably
oh,
Union.
Oh, she had to be.
Yeah.
She had to be like a Broadway
long
person.
Long time Union.
Her studio was like unbelievable. And it overlooked Union Square. Every time I go to Union Square, I think about that view.
She probably ran the Union. She
was
like
really, she was cool. I remember her measuring my hands for the gloves and everything. But then because the suit was so expensive, I had my own, this was really great. I had my own office on the 80th floor. It was a huge room. It was like probably 20 feet by 30 feet. It was a huge room. And it had a one window that faced north on the 80th floor. And I was the only one with the key. Because it was because the suit was that expensive. And I was responsible for it. So I could take the suit on and off throughout the day as much as I wanted because it was so hot. And
but
I
you had to store it
out.
In this, like, in
and
this
there was like
special
a chair
office.
And a water cooler. That's all there was. It was like a chair and a water cooler and a window that.
Wow, this suit had its own.
The Gorilla Room.
Yeah,
that's what it was called. Literally, it was called that. And you know, my first day of work, this is really too much. But my first day of work with the suit. I ended up doing a photo shoot for National Geographic with Fay Wray.
I don't know who Fay Wray is.
She's the original King Kong lady.
Wow.
Yeah. I didn't know who she was either.
Wow.
I wouldn't today if I didn't have that.
Yeah.
But it was her first trip back to the building since filming King Kong. And so I spent like an afternoon with her hanging around the Empire State Building. Like, it's really crazy.
Do you still have that picture?
I never had
cover?
The pictures. Aww. And they didn't get in the magazine. But I remembered that the photographer was a woman. And so I figured out who she was. And then I emailed her like about 20 years ago or 15 years ago or something. And I was like, hey, you know, you might remember the photo shoot with Fay Wray at the Empire State Building. I was like, I was that kid.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wonder if you have any of those pictures, you know? And I mentioned this one picture because right at the end of the shoot, I guess it was like a shoot. It was very long. And, I mean, she was like New York society incarnate. You know, she had a She had a beautiful, colorful outfit on that didn't look expensive, so it had to be ridiculous.
Yeah, you know what.
It was like one of those kinds of
like classy.
Totally 100% classy. And like
celebrity
her hair
has
was
changed,
perfect.
Hasn't it?
No, she was the movie star.
Yeah.
She was the movie star of the old, like the real Hollywood kind.
Old school.
Yeah. And so they had this bag of junk, you know, like King Kong erasers and stuff that they wanted her to take with her, but she forgot it. So I already had the head and the hands off, and they were like, "Sean, will you just go, you know, bring this out to her?" So I did, and she was. This is how cool she was. She was like standing outside the Empire State Building on Fifth Avenue, just hailing a cab. She was like in her 80s, and she was just gonna hail a cab and just go back to whatever world it is that she
beautiful,
lives in.
Beautiful, glamorous world she lived.
Our paths were not going to cross again. Whatever happened, you know what I mean?
Right.
But I was like, hey, you know, they wanted to give you this stuff, you know, whatever. Because you know, I was 16, you know?
Yeah.
And the photographer was like, hey, you know what would be a great picture is if King Kong, right?
Yeah.
I'm doing the air quotes.
Right,
we're on
he's
radio.
Doing air quotes, everyone.
Yeah, was getting Faye Ray's autograph outside the Empire State Building.
Oh, wow.
So she ended up taking this picture of me with Faye getting an autograph in the Empire State Building's in the background. So I asked her for that, and she sent me that, a slide. How cool is that? She sent a slide. I mean, she really was very generous to me. I wish I could remember her name right now.
What a time capsule. I mean, that's like if you had a time capsule, that's something that would definitely go inside it.
It's pretty cool. I mean, that whole experience, that whole summer was really cool. And then it paid for my time in Spain.
So
that worked out. New York has always kind of been that way.
Yeah, like a touchstone. Is it something that you can like go back to at different times in your life? I feel like even hard times, which certainly exist in New York City.
They definitely do.
Right? Even those, I feel like New York is still there for you, even when it feels like it's against you.
I have always felt the same way. It's funny that you say that because I lived in Barcelona and then I finished out my time at boarding school in essentially Philly. And then I was in Atlanta and L.A. and San Francisco and Chicago again and Amsterdam and a couple other places, obviously up here, a couple other places here, there. And New York was always the place I'd be like, L.A., New York, San Francisco, New York, Chicago, New York, Amsterdam,
right?
You know, like that. Like exactly what you're saying is like a touchstone.
Mm-hmm.
But now there's two things. One is the city's just a different city, which is okay. I'm not bitter about it. There are people who are bitter about that, and I'm not saying I especially like what New York has become, but I'm okay with it being other people's city now because I have my time in it or whatever.
Yeah.
But also for me, the city is a very difficult place for me to go to now, and because of the news job that I ended up doing there, which is actually another example of how generous the city has been to me. But it was a very painful and costly one.
And that's actually a good segue because though you're, if it bleeds, it leads, your one-man show, acclaimed one-man show, does originate and take place of your experience in New York City, you first showcased it in New York City, right? And won Storyteller of the Year. You won Best Storyteller of the United
of Fall
Solo.
2023.
Yes.
That's true. Well, there's a lot of things to say about that. And it's true. The first thing I think to say about that is that there is really no such thing as a one-person show because the process to get that made was really a team effort. And a lot of it actually happened here in Hudson and in Catskill. It all takes place on the streets of New York City, and that's where I lived it, and that's where it all happened. But then for 30 years, I never talked about it, not to anybody.
And can you, for those, I know there's actually quite a few listeners who probably might even have seen the show.
Seen
the show. It's wonderful. So some listeners are like, yeah, I love that show. But for those who are listening who aren't familiar with the show, can you talk a little bit about what it's about?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. So that's a good thing to do. So basically what the show is about, it's called If It Bleeds, It Leads, which is which in my house, I grew up in a television news family. My father was the producer of the CBS Evening News and the bureau chief for NBC in Saigon and on the White House desk and all that kind of stuff. And so If It Bleeds, It Leads was actually kind of like a joke around the dinner table where we watched news. You know, it was like a way of looking at the world in a way. And so that's where the title comes from. Although it's in the show because an assignment editor at NBC did say it to me one time, and I couldn't believe he said it. Like in real life, it was like, oh, there it is.
It's such an intense phrase to say.
It was
somewhat
the motto.
Casually.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of those. Yeah. Like I can't. There are a lot of things that people say when you get on the street that get very casual like that. So what the show is about is I had been kicked out of college twice for what could really only be described as subpar grades.
Okay. Well, that's not too bad.
They're probably lower than what you're expecting.
Oh, okay. I've shared some of those.
I'll tell you. I mean, I'm not ashamed of it. I don't mind. I've never met anybody else who got a grade point average this low, but I actually got a 0.25, which is pretty low.
Okay.
Yeah, it's three Fs, a D, and a never attended.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, I had to look on my, like, is that what it's called? A report
card,
right?
My pitch did go pretty high.
Yeah, no, I mean, 0.25 is like Animal House. It's like, like Mr. Blutowski, you know what I mean? It's like a report card, right? That's what you get, right?
Yeah.
It had an N/A on it, and I was like, what kind of a grade is that? But it's truly never attended. So that's what it said.
Well, I did. I had went to a Waldorf school for eighth grade, and I too share the past of not getting great grades. But mine was written in calligraphy. My F was like this flowing, beautiful.
Nice.
Oh, it was written so beautifully. Just full of like
mine
F's
was written
and
with
D's.
A big U right after it.
It was handed to me and my teacher said, "What are you wearing at graduation?" Like, yeah. And I said, I don't know, something purple.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, very, very bizarre. But
yeah,
ahead.
So anyway, so I gotten kicked out of college a couple of times and I was working at Tower Records and my dad was home, which was unusual, and I was like talking to him, and he just mentioned a production company that his friend had, and it turned out that at night there's a thing in the news business that I didn't even know about at the time, and it's that the union crews go off work at about 11 or 11:30 when the 11 o'clock news ends, and anything that happened after that would go unfilmed, I guess would be the word. Like nobody was there to cover it for them. So there was two companies in the city that would cover what happened. So basically I would drive around from 8 at night to 8 in the morning in an auctioned off cop car.
Wow.
And there was I was by myself, and then there was a guy in an office who would listen to police radios, and then he would actually page me, which was like, it was kind of like a primitive form of texting because we would listen to our competition. If you put anything out over the air, people would listen, and we could have something that they didn't know about, so we didn't do that. I mean, there was a lot of strategy involved in the way you handle things like that, but
you wanted to get there first
or only
or
but
only.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, I never got into the police radio thing, but there it gets pretty deep, and so then we would film whatever happened, and then I would drive around and drop it off to the six local TV stations, plus the two Spanish ones. And then if anybody else wanted to buy it, they could. Newspapers, the New York Times, Daily News, New York Post, CNN, they all bought stuff that I shot or guys from my office shot.
Wow. Was there anybody that you always wanted to go to first?
What do you mean?
Like any outlet that you wanted to go to first?
No, because our office was in Times Square and NBC was the closest. And there was a pattern. And I mean, but that was part of it. I mean, the driving, when I say an auctioned off cop car, what I mean is like a car that literally was a blue, like the car from the Bad Lieutenant, a blue, high suspension, just gigantic V8 motor, dual exhaust, police radios, scanners. It looked like a cop car. The cops thought we were cops.
Wow.
I mean, the driving was,
you would almost think they'd crack down
you
on that and not let you do
face.
That.
I don't think you could do it today. But no, seriously, the driving was unbelievable. Like you couldn't.
Well, you could get away with speeding anything.
I did anything I wanted to do in that car. I mean, it sounds like this right now, and this is really the only aspect of the job that I feel this way about. But I mean, it was like this kind of flippant. I mean, but like we had a portable radio that was like a walkie-talkie that we would use when we got out of the car, so that I could still communicate with the guy at the desk. I just stick it out the window while I'm driving, and everybody lets me in. We used to call it the lane changer.
What?
I mean, it was like that. And so, but everybody needs to keep in mind, like, that the New York City that we're talking about, I just know these statistics because they're in my show, but just so people understand what we're talking about. In 1993, there were 2,420 murders in New York City, which ends up being 6.3 murders a day, every day. So it's a totally different city than the one that people have become familiar with over the last 30 years. It was Brooklyn especially was really, really out of control.
Wow.
So
different Brooklyn than it is today.
Oh, huh? My God.
Yeah, barely unrecognizable.
You can. Yeah. They're not comparable.
You go to Brooklyn for artisanal ice cream now.
Yeah, my mom goes to Red Hook. I mean, I don't even know what else to say about that. Like, I had this is a great kind of encapsulation of what the job could be.
Yeah.
Because 8 o'clock at night, I was, I guess I can say it now because it doesn't matter, but when there was nothing to do because the union crews were there, I would just drive around. It's called being 98, which is police code, 1098. It means they're between jobs. They have nothing to do.
Uh-huh.
So whenever I was 98, I would just find a place to go and hang out. So one night, at the beginning of the night, I was just smoking pot on the steps of the Met when what they called a sniper started firing in the projects in Red Hook, which to me is all there is in Red Hook.
Right.
I don't know the other part of it. And it was even with everyone, Red Hook was a serious, serious place. And I got from the Met to Red Hook, which for people who don't know it is across the Brooklyn Bridge and then down underneath Gowanus. So it's a bit of a drive. And I got there in 12 minutes.
Oh, wow.
Which is pretty fast. And the guy was still firing when I got there. So I went out to Brooklyn a couple of months ago, and I went there because I wanted to go check out that spot again. That was the only job I went to that I didn't shoot because it was just too dangerous.
Well, too dangerous if you weren't you afraid to even get out of the car? I mean, he's still shooting.
Yeah, but I mean, this is going to sound like, I don't want any of this to sound like bravado because it isn't.
Mm-hmm.
But I was around a lot of gunplay, gunfire.
So you're kind of numb to it a little bit.
No, not numb to it. It's just that I can function, I could function around it. And some of the times I was around it, I was very, very close. I found where the cops were, and I ran. It was kind of funny. I ran up to them. They were transit police, which don't even exist anymore. Mm-hmm. And this guy was putting on body armor. And there was a helicopter. It was really low, and it was like kind of felt like a war in a way, like a war movie anyway. And I ran up to this guy who was like a mountain of a guy. And I only weighed 168 pounds or something at the time. I was like a scrawny dude, you know. And I was like, hey, do you think it's safe for me to shoot this right now? I had a 350-watt light on top of the camera. So basically a target. You know?
Oh,
I was like, do you think it's safe for me to do this? And the guy looks at me and he goes, I'm putting on body armor that'll stop a deer rifle shell. Did you bring that with you?
Wow.
And I was like, not tonight. And they all just started laughing at me. So I just ran back to the car. But the truth about that is that I just circled. There's a lot of people here might know this. There's a gas station right near those projects. I can't remember the name of that street, but it's under the Gowanus. And it has like a food truck there now. Mm-hmm. But it was a kind of a broken down cafeteria at the time. And I just circled there for a couple hours in case he shot a cop. But he ended up not really hitting anybody. So. But I went there that night, and then I went in. I was in Crown Heights and Bed-Stuy, and I ended up in East New York and Brownsville. This was like in maybe October or something like that. And it is a much different Brooklyn. And you know, it's not just Brooklyn because I was in Mott Haven not long ago, which is in the South Bronx, and it's a much different neighborhood now than it was. You definitely see the changes in these places.
Yeah, I mean, it's immense. And I wonder, I can't imagine being in your situation and wanting to see something that I don't want to see for my job. I mean, you sort of had to, you're hoping you catch something on camera, but the thing you're catching on camera is you saw some really, really traumatic things, right?
Well, I did, and I saw things, and a lot of things that really traumatized me, and I didn't deal with it at the time, and I didn't deal with it for decades, which personally I think is the nature of trauma, at that level. But yeah, definitely that's part of it. But I was like, the first chapter of my show, which it's called The Whitest Kid in the World, because that's like what I was, and for Westchester and boarding school and stuff. And then it's pretty exciting to get out on the street like that.
Wow.
And to, I mean, the city, I had total access to the city. Mm-hmm. Any place I was just as good as any of the other. And everywhere I went, I think one thing that's important to understand is for people is that everywhere I went, people were good to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the people on the street. And it took me time to learn how to relate to people who were from such a different environment than the one that I grew up in.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really hard personal lessons, which I'm happy to talk about.
Yeah,
but
can you give an example?
I can. I can give lots of examples. But the one that really sticks out the most is that I was at a perp walk one night in the A3, that's how people say police stations, you know, and that's
and a perp walk is when they do the walk and you a lineup or
no
or, okay.
No, a perp walk is like when it's actually kind of it's a constitutional violation of a person's rights, but when when the police want to assure the community that they have their man or whatever, they arrest somebody for some crime. Then they parade them out in front of the police.
Wow.
And it's usually a guy. Oh, you've seen him, like where they're kind of bent over and they got their hands cuffed and they're getting put into the back of a police car.
Mm-hmm.
He's a perp, a perpetrator, right?
Yeah.
And they're walking. So they call it a perp walk. But they make sure that the press knows about them for some things. And like that was also part of the world of the assignment editor was they had a thing back then called DCPI, which is the Department of Public Information. And they used to send out faxes and let you know who was getting walked or for what and stuff. So I ended up at this perp walk for a kid who shot a girl at school.
Mm.
And I made several assumptions along the way that were really, they were all incorrect and hurtful. Irresponsible for me to say, but everywhere I had gone up until that point, it was because somebody gotten killed, and there was I was used to that. And there was a woman in the room with me in this little room waiting for the perp walk, and I assumed she asked why I was there, and I just said, "Well, this kid killed a girl at school today."
Yeah,
but she hadn't died. I found out later, and it started to feel like maybe I started to feel like I had told that woman that her daughter was murdered at school that day, which is that's a very intense thing.
Yeah.
And then I did the walk, and then I bump into a street crime cop that I knew at the time. Street crime, everybody pretty much knows is stop and frisk.
Mm-hmm.
They just go for guns. So he asked me what I was doing there, and I told him, and he was like, "Well, actually, you know, she didn't die. He grazed her face and shot her in the stomach. But she's going to live." And it turned out that wasn't the girl's mother. It was the boy's mother.
Oh, wow.
So it was a total, I made a lot of assumptions that night.
They would send a shiver, a terrifying shiver of panic.
It was pretty
intense,
you know. And I realized, you know, that a couple of things, which were like, you know, I didn't know that I assumed that the girl had died because that's kind of what the gig was.
You were used to seeing that.
Yeah. And I thought that I had told this woman that her daughter was murdered at school, but what I actually did do and take responsibility for doing is I told her that her son was a murderer.
Oh.
but he wasn't.
Right, right.
Right? So that's a thing.
Big lesson.
Yeah. And then the last thing that really is the most painful, what is not any longer, but was the most painful, and this all happened within a couple minutes. Like, mm-hmm. I talked to this cop, mm-hmm. and I found out this stuff, and then I went back to the crew car, which is that auctioned-off cop car, and this mm-hmm. is on the street in Bushwick, and Bushwick at the time is a much, much different neighborhood. I mean, it's nothing. I have a good Bushwick story. a much mm-hmm. different place. And so what I really realized, after I realized how wrong I was about everything, mm-hmm. I realized actually that the thing that I was most wrong about was that I didn't realize that a boy who shoots a girl at school would have a mother who loves him.
Right.
And that's a cultural realization mm-hmm. in a way, because, or whatever the right word there is, that may not be it, but because I just started thinking about like who I am and where I'm from and how we get into mm-hmm. each other's business and say things mm-hmm. kind of offhandedly that we don't really know very much about, whereas mm-hmm. on the street, which is really where I spent all my time at that. I was either sleeping or I was on the street mm-hmm. for about 18 months. It's a totally different set of rules out there. And I started to think about the people who I was around every night and the situations that they live in. A lot of them are in the projects or a disenfranchised neighborhood somewhere in the city. Mm-hmm. And
because you're not just viewing, you're interacting.
Well, you start to realize, you know, like, there were other events I was at, too, a shooting in Brownsville where it was on my 22nd birthday, actually. Mm-hmm. The police shot this kid in the Brownsville houses, and that was when I kind of realized that there's more than one America. I never had that experience mm-hmm. before. And so these things kind of kept happening, but the process for learning them, the mistakes that I made along the way, I mean, the truth about it is I feel like I hurt people by being irresponsible. Mm-hmm. But then later I realized I really shouldn't have been, like, I was very young and I was doing the best I could.
You were very young and you were in a supercharged situation. It's not like, you know, most 18, 19, 20-year-olds are learning their life lessons by, you know, don't forget to give the customer back the correct change at their first, you know, smoothie job, right, the smoothie making job. For those who are just tuning in, I'm talking to Sean Allison about his show, If It Bleeds. If it bleeds, it leads. And we're getting into some great, great details about the show. I do have a question, too. How did this, because you came from this news-heavy household.
Yeah.
Did you ever share that, like, go home and share this with your dad, like, these experiences?
Some of them I did, because some of them were big stories, you know. Mm-hmm. And if he was home when I got home, he wanted to know what I did that night. Because mm-hmm. he was up to that stuff, you know. Like, he was into things like that. You know, like when I was a kid, 48 Hours, that TV show, mm-hmm. started with a three-hour special called 48 Hours on Crack Street, and he's the producer of it. And I remember him going on crack house raids.
Wow. So he'd been on the street as well. He wasn't just reporting.
No. He was in – my father, I mean, as far as his career went, he actually did a news story about the Black Panthers where he rode around with Eldridge Cleaver and Bobby Seale in Oakland and knew those guys and put a story on, I think, NBC for them. But he was also a reporter on the air for NBC from the Ambassador Hotel the night Bobby Kennedy was assassinated. So he has that career. I have totally the opposite, you know, and just kind of how that cookie crumbled, I guess. That was local news. That was totally different. But, he was interested.
Was he worried? Did he express worry? No?
No. Wow. But my mom did.
Yeah.
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 No, I mean, the fear part of it, this is what I meant before when I was saying there's really no such thing as a one-person show mm-hmm. and how there's part of it got developed up here, because I had all this in me for 30 years, and it is impossible to say how reluctant I was to talk about it. I just did not talk about it.
Mm-hmm. And we were kind of talking about this earlier. You didn't even really talk about it with your significant others or
nobody.
Your partners.
No, nobody. I mean, they knew some of it. They knew that I did the job, mm-hmm. and they knew the circumstances of it, and they knew, like, you know, the story about the cat.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I was there, I was at 770 Eastern Parkway, which is the headquarters for the Lubavitcher Jewish sect in Crown Heights, and the night that Grand Rebbe Menachem Schneerson died, I was there for that. So like, I filmed a riot one time in Staten Island, like stories like that, that were pretty accessible people. I would tell people about, but there's a lot of other ones that
and those stories you could, because you could talk about the event not the way you felt about an event.
Well, you know, that's, I never thought about it that way, but that's probably true. I think the stories about murders and fires and car accidents and things, I think what doesn't communicate to people when they watch it for entertainment on TV, including the news maybe, is how personal all that is.
And did that affect the way even today when you see, because there's so much violence in film and television, and I'm not here to say that there shouldn't be, but a lot of it is for entertainment value. There's a rock song playing on the soundtrack of the film. There's, you know, a couple of jokes from the lead actor as he's shooting his gun. I mean, it's delivered very lightly in a lot of, and when you see that, do you have a different take on it? Or can you get carried away with the, you know, the lighter entertainment aspect of it?
That's interesting, because for a long time I didn't have any problem with any of it, except for one movie. Man, what's it called? That Clint Eastwood movie with Sean Penn where they're like cops in Rhode Island.
Oh, that's such a good movie. And
there's a scene in there where they discover the girl's body in the car, and Sean Penn's like hired goons run under the crime scene tape. And I was at a murder in Sheepshead Bay of a young guy that was very, very similar to that. And that was one time when I had a kind of a reaction. But I didn't quite get it. And then I didn't have any trouble with it until about 3 years ago, when I really started having problems watching violence on TV, especially if it was similar to something that I've seen. So if it's a show like The Wire.
Wow. Which is
great. I love The Wire.
Realistic and gritty.
It's more realistic, I think, than a lot of shows. People, a crime scene, which is what people really call where a murder happens, is a really slow, serious, somber place. And the homicide detectives are so super professional and serious about it. It's a different kind of a thing than on TV. I mean, there's like 80 people in the crime scene, and they're taking pictures of everything, and there's like this ridiculous tape outline on the floor, which they do not use, of course. And like, I mean, a real crime scene is like, it gets shut down and then nobody goes in there.
Wow.
Not other cops, not anybody. The only people who go in there are the people who need to be in there. And then, because in my experience, the police who are investigating that feel a very personal responsibility to the family of the victim. And they don't want something that they can control, which is the crime scene. They don't want that messed with, you know. It's very serious.
It's portrayed very differently on television.
it definitely is, you know. And I don't under any circumstances watch like crime scenes unit, CSI. I mean, they're just like they're.
Did this is there a parallel between when you really stopped being able to watch it and the development of your show?
Definitely. So this gets into the thing like about what came from here, because I started writing about it in a class that I was taking up here, a short story writing class. And then a woman who runs On the Fly Story Slam, which is great, Caitlin Langstaff is her name. They started that. And so I was like, oh, you know, I'll start telling stories. But I didn't talk about that. But then eventually, like one or two of those started to come out about because I have some really nice ones about, you know, a woman with muscular dystrophy running her sixth New York marathon and stuff like that.
Yeah. Heartwarming.
Yeah. That was a beautiful night. It was amazing. That was an amazing night. You know, great New York night. A lot of my stories are great New York nights. They're hard, you know, but they're all about New Yorkers and real New York people. And I really, that's the thing, like there's a price to pay for, it's a serious price mm-hmm. that I paid for doing that. But there's a lot of benefit to it as well, because I just love the people of New York City, and they've been yeah. they've been very good to me, and yeah. I understand them, and they understand me, and I'm very comfortable there, and
yeah.
and there's a lot of personal experience there that mm-hmm. that I really value. I forgot what we were even talking
well,
about.
Well, how the parallel between not being able to watch Inner Tenet led, but you started telling these
stories. So I started telling
stories,
and then Caitlin was the first, the truth about it is that, so I started telling stories, and then that process went on for years, like the process of like 3 or 4 years mm-hmm. of like constantly telling stories over mm-hmm. and over again, mm-hmm. Different stories, and then I did start telling some of these stories about the street, and then...
Do you remember how it felt your first one? Was your
oh man, but
beat,
I'll tell you what,
beating in your chest.
I'll tell you what, I was terrified. Yeah. Not even, I mean, I could have been telling a story about like making eggs, like yeah. anything. Forget about like a real story about a crime yeah. scene or something yeah. like that. I could not have done that. Could yeah. not have done it. I was
well,
terrified.
I've always known you as a musician, and I've seen you play a lot of music,
yeah.
right? I think I first saw you play music in 2016, 2017.
With Pat
Steely
Dinn.
Yes, yeah.
yeah,
PG6,
yeah, that was great.
Right?
He's
so
great.
I have always known you as a musician, and then, you know, I moved back. I was in L.A. for a little bit. I moved
yeah.
back, and then I remember seeing you at the... Story Slam at
yeah,
Avalon.
No, right.
And then, so I was watching, I would hear your stories, and then your show came, you know, came about, and I saw, I think, one of the first versions.
At Spotty?
At Spotty.
That was the first one, yeah. because what ended up happening was, Caitlin was really the first person that I ever met that I trusted in any way with this stuff. And I was disgusted with the news business.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of what I was getting to before. Like,
mm-hmm.
I had a vision, like, bad people live in bad neighborhoods kind of thing.
Yeah.
And, like, a vision of who people are. And I realized that night in the 8-3 after that thing at the Perp Walk that that's really just a lie and create something that in my lifetime
mm-hmm.
My life has been created by watching the news.
Mm-hmm.
But meeting the people and treating the people of New York City, I mean, the people
yeah.
who I met
yeah.
covering news, and treating them as individuals changed all that in such a personal way. And so my last night of work, I photocopied the paperwork for every job I delivered, which
mm-hmm.
Is the description and then who bought it, because
mm-hmm.
I wanted to make a movie about showing how, frankly, racist and unfair the news is
mm-hmm.
to people who are...
What would you say, even what we call or what we would consider liberal news... stations that we watch, if you're liberal, are still perpetuating false narratives about.
Well,
about
I mean, I, you know,
even if it's just by omission of their individuality,
I agree.
Stories,
and
yeah.
this, like, who gets on the news for what, and who doesn't get on the news for the same thing
mm-hmm.
is kind of an interesting,
yeah.
you know. And so I made this stack of photocopies, and it's like that. It's like 3 inches tall. and I've always called it my 3-inch stack of mayhem and murder.
Oh,
right?
Wow.
And that's exactly what it is. I mean, if
wow.
you read it, it's pretty crazy.
Wow.
And so I actually, Caitlin had it at her house for like months. I mean, it was a big deal for me. And then we got a version of the show out there. And then in all honesty, I don't think I was ready to get real deep into that at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up having a really hard winter emotionally and psychologically, and it was all kind of this seeping. Like, I feel like I cracked open the seal,
mm-hmm.
and then it was like, and then the pressure, like a champagne bottle
wow.
or something, you know?
Yeah.
And then I ended up, I was like, well, I got to do something with the show. So I just submitted it to the United Solo Festival in the spring of 2023, and not expecting to get in, but I did. And I was like, wow, that's great. Oh, my God. What am I going to do? You know, exactly. Like, what am I going to do now? You know? And then that was pretty amazing because the theater is only 2 blocks away from where I did the job. I did
wow.
the job on 42nd and 7th, and the theater's on 42nd and 9th.
What a strange full
circle.
Oh,
my God. That was, I mean, I don't even know how much time I spent thinking about that.
Wow.
Right? And then I was walking down Warren Street one day, thinking about what to do with this opportunity to have the show in Theater Row. Like, it was a big deal. And
mm-hmm.
and then just by chance, I bumped into a woman who, a total stranger, and we started talking. Her name's Shay DeLynn. Probably there's a lot of
yeah.
people out here who know her.
Yeah.
And
she's great. Pieces at
yeah.
at the Park Theater was so good that you were also in.
I had a tiny little part. But yeah, I met her and she is a, for those of you who don't know her, she's a very experienced and accomplished actor and a producer and director and had done a little bit of one-person show directing before, but was looking to do something like that. And she liked, I mean, she was into the project that I was working on. So we decided to work on it. And really, I mean, she really invested a lot in the creation of the show. And it's a brutal process because the subject matter is so intense, you know, and combined with the fact that it was the first time I was ever talking about any of these stories with anybody. But at the same time, within 3 or 4 days, I got cast as Oberon at Churchtown Dairy for Carol Russoff. That was great. And then I got a therapist.
Okay. I was cast as Oberon, and then I got a therapist.
It was like the perfect thing. And he's a guy. He's a guy who only he was in charge of the military's mental health unit at Ground Zero on September 11th that night. And he figured out a real pro. Yeah, he's the right guy, and he figured out. So it's pretty much what I'm left with is these two conditions that are basically combat vet. One's called moral injury, which mostly people outside of the veteran community don't know about, and one is called the complex PTSD, which, you know.
So you were able to put a name to these feelings the first time, and actually, because once was there a feeling of like, well, now that I can put a name to these feelings, I can actually really deal with the feelings.
They're 100%
in a structured way.
Totally, absolutely. Yeah. And you know, he was like, I didn't even know there would be a diagnosis, you know.
Right.
And then he's like, "I have a diagnosis for you," and I was like, "Okay." and he goes, "You know, I almost misdiagnosed you 4 times, but I didn't say anything." And I always think about how grateful I am that he didn't say anything until he was sure that he was right.
Because well, it goes having back to that structure, lesson, but also that lesson where you were talking about before, misspeaking.
Yeah. Well, you don't want to do that.
You don't want to misspeak.
You're right. having that structure. And then it's opened up ways for me to, like, I have storytelling events for veterans.
Wow.
One from Hudson participated. People know him. I don't want to use his name on the air in case he doesn't want it, but people know him.
Yeah.
And then a friend of mine who has got he was in the Army and had he's like the guy you read about, a drug habit, the time in the in prison, and then had a dog, and my friend who had military sexual trauma in the Air Force. So,
but what's amazing, it sounds like once you were able to find the right support, you turned that around and were able to be supportive.
I'm trying, doing that is actually helping me too. Like I was telling you off air, like even the Q&As, I just did my show and just talking to people because they're interested because they see all this fake murder stuff on TV too.
Yeah.
But now they have access to somebody who's really seen it, and their questions are really interesting.
We're running out of time, and I so badly wanted to get to one of those questions. God, we have like 2 minutes. Can you do one real quick? Can you do one in a minute?
Well, I actually
what was the question you got at the Q&A after your show? Your favorite one?
The one that people always ask me. People always ask about what happened to the love interest in the show too. Mara Rose. We're still friends, so that's good. But really, people ask if I watch those crime scene shows. They're really interested in that, and I tell them no. And I had a funny experience at Berkeley this weekend, and somebody asked, and I was like, no, I do not watch them. And I'm just gonna add something, you know, like if I was a woman and I was dating a guy. I had my set of experiences, but I was a woman and I was dating a guy who was like really into those shows, especially the ones that combine sex and murder. I would probably end that relationship like and just move on. Those shows are kind of creepy to me. I don't like them. And there was a woman in the audience who she was a young woman, and I think she was maybe special needs, and she's like, "You don't even watch murder," she wrote.
Oh, that's sweet.
So I know, it was really great. And
that's
I watch Murder, She Wrote. Angela
not.
Lansbury, you know, so interacting with the people has really been great.
Yes. Yeah. And also there's more interacting because you are producing, we've got about 30 seconds left, you're producing an improv workshop at Park
Theater? No, it's a live performance.
Oh,
it's called the Improv Aquarium.
Yeah,
there's like nine. I'm not one of them. There's people who really do improv.
Okay.
First Monday of every month, Improv Aquarium.
At the Park Theater in Hudson. So go there for all the information. And this is WGXC 90.7 Radio for Open Ears. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, everybody.
Sean.
Thank you, Simone.
This has been WGXC. Such a lovely afternoon.